This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to The Science Bug. I'm Simon Connolly.
And I'm Morgan Marion.
This week, Morgan is interviewing the brilliant Greer Sanger about our native red admiral butterflies, or kahukura. Greer's research focused on their relationship with nettles, both the introduced species and the infamous native onga-onga. Specifically, she wanted to know whether females prefer to lay their eggs on the introduced nettle or the native onga-onga.
Amazing. And so you look at the kahukura, the red cloak, the endemic red admiral. What kind of got you interested in that butterfly?
Well, so I started off in Janine Yant's lab doing like summer studentship stuff, and we were working with bumblebees because that's Janine's main thing, wasps, bees, bumblebees. And I really enjoyed doing a lot of that, but I wanted to work with something that was native.
Fair enough.
I was like, okay, what can I work with? And I'm ironically scared of most bugs. So it was kind of like, yeah, like I had like getting over the fear with the bumblebees even kind of thing. Like they had the advantage of they're pretty like bumbly and cute, but like all the legs, I had like a phobia of it. So
are you over it now?
No, not fully.
This is still a working progress.
Still a work in progress.
So wait, how do you go to the entomology society conferences? It must be quite like traumatic for you.
Like pictures I'm okay with, like that's fine. I can like appreciate them at a distance, but like if I had to like touch one or hold one, I'm like, no way. Especially spiders in particular.
What about my dear stick insects?
I have actually held one of those. I managed to do it.
And it was fine.
That was okay. Yeah.
They're cute, they're harmless, right?
I was sort of like, oh, once I started like crawling up here.
Yeah.
Like, nope.
They've got little hooks on their feet, so they can be a little bit like ticklish.
But while I was down here it was fine, but just like once I felt like, oh my god, it's gonna go in my clothing or something. Then I was like, no.
But so the butterflies now you're fine with?
I remember when I was a lot younger, I really liked butterflies, and at some point I looked at them with like a magnifying glass, and then I was terrified. It's like that thing in SpongeBob, there's the butterfly episode, and then they've got like zoom in, and it's like a fly. It's not actually a butterfly, but like it looks like scary. It was like that, and then for ages afterwards, I was terrified of them. And then I don't know, at some point along the line, I guess I got over it again.
Do you feel that as if you learn more about an organism and you start to understand why it looks the way it does, do you think that does help with your fear?
Definitely. Yeah. And like, I guess also spending more time around them and learning their behavior also helps, because then you can kind of almost like guess what they're going to do. Because I think that's a lot of the thing. Like, they've got tons of legs. They could go in like any direction. They could do anything.
The unexpectedness.
You can't expect it.
I see.
Like with mammals, if they also have like kind of facial expressions, like you can kind of read how they're feeling and what they're going to do to a certain extent. Whereas bugs, I feel like you really can't. So yeah, I went to the museum because once I kind of decided moths and butterflies were like the thing that I found the least scary to work with. I was like, maybe I should actually test this, and I'm okay with them like landing on me and that kind of thing. Because like I haven't really had that in a long time. So I went to like the museum, the butterfly house, and I was like, let's just see if I can handle it. And I was like, okay, I can do it. It's good. So now I just think they're really like cute and pretty, and
that's good. And so what is it about the kahukura that kind of brought you to them?
I guess it was a multiple things. I guess like the first main ones that it was native and endemic.
We're not really known for the land of native butterflies here in New Zealand, are we?
No. Definitely not. We don't have that many butterflies, but we've got tons of moths. So we've got a huge, like, I think we've got one of the highest rates of, like, endemism for moths.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it kind of would have been cool to work with moths, but a lot of them are, of course, night time, and I was like, I don't know if I'm ready to do like field work straight away at night.
Mm-hmm.
Like I need my sleep. So
and yet somehow you ended up doing field work with one of the most notorious plants in New Zealand.
Yes. Yeah. So Jenny was actually really thrilled about that because it like kept with the theme of the lab of like
stinging
plants. So instead of wasps and bees, it was butterflies. So I was like, oh, it's not stinging, but oh wait, the plants sting. So
actually, yeah,
it was great.
That is so cool.
Yeah. We got stung a lot.
By the tree nettles?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of stings. They're not actually too bad, but...
Yeah, I was about to ask, yeah. Do they hurt? What does it feel like?
It's like nowhere near as painful as like a bee sting or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know how to explain it. It's just like a stinging sensation, and then it kind of, after a little bit, it goes numb, which is very weird. And it's like just the skin that goes numb, though.
Mm-hmm.
So... And then if you, like, go have, like, a shower later or, like, any water goes on it again, the sting will kind of come back again.
It, like, so, reactivates it.
Yeah. I don't know why, but it does.
That's really interesting. So, has anybody kind of looked at the actual chemical of the plant?
Yeah, there's some studies on it. I don't really know exactly what they were looking at because it's all, like, chemistry stuff that I don't understand.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the molecular compounds, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's over my head, like all the symbols. But, they were looking at it to try and work out what it is that makes the sting and then what it is that makes the numbing effect, because that potentially could be useful for, like, a pain medication.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some people were interested in it in that respect, because... the Māori used to use the onga-onga leaves in like ointments with like kawakawa leaves and that kind of thing to make like balms and stuff. And that was to help with pain, like full like skin pains, like eczema and that kind of thing. So there's potentially, like, it could be quite useful for reducing pain.
Yeah, there's like avenues there.
Yeah.
What does onga-onga mean in Te Reo Māori? Does it refer to the fact that it's a stinging plant to like stay away?
Yeah, so not specifically stinging, but it's like distaste or dislike,
mm-hmm.
something that's not nice. So it's aversive. So like sandflies, any plant that hurts you, I guess.
Yeah.
Would be like.
That's so cool. Yeah.
So I don't know if it's used too much in that way now, but I think historically it was.
These butterflies and the stinging nettle, what is happening there?
The stinging nettles, we've got a mix of native and introduced ones.
Okay.
And I can't remember off my head how many there are,
but
there's quite a few. And the main one of the native ones that we know quite well is the onga-onga, which is the tree nettle. It's quite big and it's more viney, I feel like, and bush-like than tree-like. But I guess it's, like, kind of woody compared to the other nettles, which are very just, like, stems, like plant stems.
We should reach out to plant biologists ask them why what is happening there with the name.
Yeah.
And so this tree nettle is a host plant for the kahukura?
Yes, yeah. So, it's the kahukura are... very like host specific, so they can only lay eggs on nettles. And we don't know all of which species they can do that on, but we know they definitely do it on the onga-onga a lot and the Chatham Island nettle, and we've also seen it quite a bit on a lot of the introduced ones like Urtica urens, which is the little dwarf nettle that's very common in like people's backyards and compost places, farmland. And like I think also Urtica dioica and just a lot of the introduced ones as well. Mm-hmm. They can probably lay eggs on all of the nettles, we would assume, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah, so that's what your research mostly looked at, just kind of which nettle are they most likely to lay their eggs on and do well on?
That would have been really great, but we couldn't get access to all the different nettle species. So some of them are, like, very, very rare and only in very specific places. Yeah, so it's hard to find wild populations of a lot of the native ones.
Is that because people get rid of it? Or is it just because it's just naturally quite rare, not very abundant?
I feel like it's probably a mix of both, like some of the species. I'm not entirely sure.
Need more research than that, yeah.
It's not, there's not much known about them at all, which made things kind of hard because whenever I was trying to find out where to find all these things, it was like iNaturalist, so the only thing could use in this.
Thank God for iNaturalist.
Yeah. It helped, for sure.
I've done the same for stick insects.
Yeah.
I get to a new place, I'm like, all right, where are the stick insects?
Mm.
And you just iNaturalist.
Yeah. It's hope. but yeah, some of the species, there's like 5 observations, maybe.
In New Zealand?
Yeah. So like, oh, wow. Some of them are like very, very rare. So unfortunately, we couldn't test all of them.
Yeah.
but no, it's just the ones that we could get our hands on and in time do my
of course.
Masters.
Yeah.
So we only ended up with 3. Because like even with like the well-known native or common introduced ones, they're seen as weeds and like not many people are going to buy seeds and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it was really hard to find anywhere that sold seeds. We did find the Moths and Butterflies of New Zealand Trust. They had some seeds for sale for Onga Onga and Chatham Island Nettle and I think it was Urtica Aspera, which is another sort of rarer one. It's like a much smaller one. Yeah, so I got those 3 and then I tried to grow them out. And I tried to look for seeds for introduced ones, but that's just like, no one sells that.
Do you naturally have a green thumb? Or was this kind of gardening and you're like, oh gosh?
Well, I definitely have quite a bit of experience gardening, but not with nettles and those kind of native plants. They have like really, really long germination times.
Mm-hmm.
So you think like, oh, it's not working. Like they're just the dead seeds. Like it's not working like months and months just to see any germination. So it's very odd.
But you also don't have months and months to wait. You know,
I started quite early on in my like papers year of growing the plants. But it worked. The Urtica Aspera didn't germinate at all.
Okay.
They were like really, really small seeds. So I think maybe they just needed either completely different conditions or just way less soil on top or maybe mm-hmm. none. And with the other ones, they germinated. Yeah, got a lot of those. So it had a whole like green house that was just full of Unga Unga and Chatham Island plants. But it turned out the seeds weren't actually Chatham Island plants.
Oh no.
They were a hybrid. So it was Chatham Island nettle crossed with Urtica dioica, which is an introduced plant. So we ended up with like a native introduced hybrid.
Oh.
Which wasn't intentional, but it kind of worked. Like, because we were kind of looking at like native introduced, which is better in a way with the nettles. So it sort of seemed like it was almost intentional, even though it really wasn't.
Just accidental.
Yeah.
Because obviously there's a subgenus of the red admiral that's on the Chatham Islands.
Yes.
And so you're saying that there's a Chatham Island nettle that's there as well. So you'd imagine that, you know, they're having their thing together.
Mm.
And if you switch one out, maybe it wouldn't work or maybe it still would.
Yeah. So that's kind of the idea, like the co-evolution of the plants. So they should be more, I guess, adapted to those native plants that they're, that's in the same area mm-hmm. as those populations are. So therefore, with that co-evolution through time, they shouldn't do so well on the other nettles that weren't there. So that's the idea of like the native introduced thing. And that's what we saw.
So that's what you found?
Yeah.
That they do better on their own kind
native
of
plants. Oh. Yeah.
So that's good.
That was the best one. But the Chatham hybrid one was also really good, which makes sense because the Chatham Island nettle obviously is really good for the Chatham subspecies of kahukura.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably quite similar, like, you know, and there's some Chatham Island nettle that's also like Southland area as well on the mainland. So,
and so the one that works was the introduced nettle.
Okay, yeah.
But at the same time, that introduced nettle is also the one that's kind of becoming more widespread amongst
the most common. Yeah, I mean, like, there's no scientific research done on like the abundance of their species. There's no hard thing of like, yes, these are definitely more abundant. But just
more research. Yes,
we can kind of see that that's definitely the case. It's just like, yeah, it's like especially in urban areas and pastoral like farming landscapes, and that's because people don't really like being stung by ulunga. They see it as like a horrible weed and they don't really know the benefits of it, so a lot of it gets removed, because like a lot of people are worried about like their dogs or children or something like running into it, and that has happened, and that unfortunately does end in the death of the dog. Yeah, blindly runs in, gets tons of stings all over it. So yeah, it's a dangerous plant, but it's like if we educate people on it, then I feel like it would be a lot better because people would know not to just let your dog run into it.
It's quite a complex message to get out, because in one way you're telling them, well, get rid of that nettle, please, but can you please keep the other nettle, this native nettle that we need?
Yeah.
Is that what you want people to or would you kind of just go with, let's keep all nettles?
So that's kind of what I was looking at. So I was wanting to see if it was an ecological trap was happening because of the introduced nettle. And their idea is if there was an ecological trap, then we would want to be getting rid of the introduced nettle and keeping the native nettle. So that's why I looked at both oviposition preference of the adults and the larval performance. So with the oviposition preference, the adults preferred to lay the eggs on the natives. So I think 8 laid eggs on Ongaonga and 2 laid eggs on the Chatham hybrid. And then none at all ever chose to lay on the introduced.
Wow.
But we have seen them doing that in the wild, but they just obviously don't choose to when they have.
It must be a last resort. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what we're thinking is possibly the case.
Oh, so, wow.
It's only like 10 individuals as well, so like that also needs to be kept in mind. But it's also,
but it's definitely a beginning, and
so there's that side of it. And then with the larval performance, they it was kind of weird, it was mixed results. So the survival, there's no significant difference in survival rates, but they did, the best survival was on the Chatham hybrid, which was interesting. And then the other two did similarly, but it was worse on the introduced, but none of it was significant, so it's kind of like, you know. And then for the pupa weights, which is kind of like our main indicator of how well they were developing, pupa weight is like connected to fecundity, especially for female butterflies, so that's kind of how we were measuring that and like, their fitness. So the pupa were heavier if they were raised on Ongaonga, followed by the Chatham, followed by the introduced. So it had like the same
matches the pattern. Egg. Yeah, oviposition.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which was, interesting. And that was a significant difference. So, yeah, they tended to be way heavier if they were on Ongaonga.
Were you able to rear any to adulthood?
Oh, yeah, yes. That's what we did. We tried to rear all of them to adulthood. A lot of them did die.
Lepidoptera are quite finicky to rear. For anyone that knows, they're just quite sensitive.
Yeah, so I think we had like 50% survival rate on the Chatham Island hybrid, which was pretty good, I think, from what I can tell from other things. And for the Ongaonga and the introduced bit of coherence, I think it was around 15%. So it was like way lower, but for some reason was significant. I don't really know why, but seems a lot lower. But anyway, so lots made it to adulthood, and a lot also didn't. And ones that did become adults, we then released them back into the wild for preferably at the locations when we called them, is what we tried to do. But sometimes we weren't really able to because we're limited with how many trips we could do.
Of course. So kind of, have you kind of got a population going now in Dunedin somewhere that like you're like, this is my spot? Maybe you want to keep that secret, actually.
Possibly. There's certain sites that we found that were like really good for finding them.
I've seen them at Orokanui. Yeah. They do quite well there.
Yeah, so we planted leftover onga onga plants from my study there as well.
Nice.
Because there weren't any onga onga at Orokanui beforehand. So, yeah, and they wanted some because historically it would have been there. So we gave them some, and I think Taylor, he sent me an email at some point confirming that he's actually seen eggs or larvae on them. So the butterflies there are actually starting to use.
That's them. Amazing. How do they find the plants? Are they using pheromone smells?
Yeah, I think like just like the chemical cues given off from the plants, probably some visual cues as well. But yeah, not entirely sure on how that all works. Like they're very understudied, but based on species, like in other places around the world, that tends to be how it's done.
Yeah.
With chemical cues and stuff.
When they lay their eggs on the plants, are they laying it on the leaves, on the stems? Are they kind of trying to put it near any of the stingers? Do they choose?
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure to what extent because I didn't specifically look at that. But Nicole, she looked at that. She was a PG Dip Psy, and so she kind of came along with me for some of my stuff. And then she was kind of, analysing that in the wild of how they lay their eggs on the plants. And I think the thing that she found is they mostly lay them on the leaves, I think mostly on the top side, but they tend to do it near or on like the stingers. So
wow,
the correlation between the stingers and the eggs.
So they're very much aware, like, you know, like I need to get close to the stingers as possible.
Yeah.
Protect my babies.
Probably, yeah. I think so.
That is so cool.
So one of the things they do to test the plants to see if they're good or not, like which one they want the...
So they actually test the plants?
Yeah, so I don't know if they do this every time or not, but like in my overposition cages, I saw a few of them doing this, I forgot what the behaviour, what the word for it is.
Do they palpate? Do they, with the antennae or with the legs?
It's with their front two vestigial legs that are usually folded up really tight against their body. So they're all like hairy and bristly and it's like chemosensilla in them, and then they kind of like shoot them out, and then kind of like a praying mantis does, you know, like shoots them out and then like rubs them against the leaves of the plant. So they're like testing the chemicals of the plant
to see
if it's like the right plant.
If it's good,
yeah. So I saw them do that, which is really, really cool.
That is so cool. So it's not,
Yeah, so
just make sure it's the right nettle and it's got the right level of. Pain or, you know, chemical.
Whatever chemical is about it. We don't know which chemical that is. Well, multiple chemicals probably. But yeah, we don't know what it is that they like about the nettles and what they need from the nettles. So it's like.
Were you surprised that in 2022, now 2023, that nobody had ever really looked at any of this, that this was. You'd think, you know.
Yeah, definitely. It's also a very, like, it's a very bright, vibrant, like, beautiful butterfly. So I was expecting, like, quite a bit of research on it.
Mm-hmm.
That was, like, one of the main points of also why I ended up picking it, is because it's easy for me to, like, identify in the field and catch instead of trying to get some cryptic brown moth or something. So that was another big part of it. I was expecting there to be quite a bit of research, and I think there was one PhD that was done previously on them, and that was pretty much all I could find other than, like, some really, really old textbooks of, like, Lepidopterists that had, like, written some general, like,
basic descriptions. Basic
biology stuff about them. Yeah. But, yeah, so there's so much that we don't know still. It's crazy. But, yeah, the PhD, though, was quite cool. I think it was Mandy Barron. think it was back in like 2004-ish, and it was in Christchurch, and they were looking at like the parasite effects, parasitoid wasps.
The non-target effects.
Yeah.
That's right.
On the butterflies. So,
because in terms of their conservation, it seems to be on multiple fronts, right? It seems to be that they don't have their right host plants there because the tree nettles are getting removed.
Yep.
But also there's been these introductions of parasitoid wasps that were there to control other insects and have maybe had non-target effects on our kahukura that could also be leading to their decline.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are the leading things at the moment, I think, on like suggestions of why there's been this anecdotal decline. I think the other things like increase like spraying and that kind of thing as well. Those three things are probably not doing so great for them.
Yeah. And when you talk to the public about the red admiral and that it's in decline, but we need the tree nettle for it, what are kind of people's reactions? Are they keen for it until you tell them about the nettle side of it and they're a bit more like,
It kind of depends. If they're people that like butterflies and they know about this butterfly, then they tend to be quite keen about it. But a lot of people don't actually even know this butterfly exists at all. And I'm like, it's flying around here in Dunedin. Like,
it's bright red and black.
Yeah.
It's quite a large butterfly.
One. Like, yeah. I don't know. I guess they're solitary, so it's like a lot of people aren't probably going to see them or like, they're just going to glance past and not really realize that it's there.
Yeah.
And they're not super abundant anymore, so it's also... It's just like in certain places where there seems to be.
I never saw one when I was in Auckland. It was all.
They're not there.
They're not there, right?
Yeah.
But historically, they would have been there a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes me sad. Let's reintroduce it back. Yeah. Come on, Aucklanders.
Historically, I think they were kind of everywhere, like across the country. Same with Oonga. But both of those are not found Auckland and above anymore. And in certain like places in the North Island, other places as well, I think, with it. Also kind of found.
So do you think if we plant Oonga Oonga, the butterfly will come?
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, that's the idea, but I'm not sure. There could be something else to do with, like, the warming climate maybe as well. Like, that might also have something to do with it.
More research for you.
Yeah.
Like, I can see a full PhD for you.
Oh, yeah. We've got so many different things we want to look at.
You can hear more about Greer's struggles and triumphs with butterflies and nettle stings next week, including how you track a butterfly flying away from you at the speed of a car. Spoiler alert, you don't. You've been listening to The Science Bug with Simon Connolly and Morgan Marion. You can find us at ScienceBugPod on Instagram and Twitter. This podcast is made possible by Free FM, and you can find our previous episodes on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app. Catch you next time.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.